Welcome to the Big Fan Theory. Greg, welcome to the Big Fan Theory.
Thank you very much for having me, Bob.
Yeah, really excited to chat to you today. Now, I imagine most people will know who you are, but I always ask people at the beginning, in 30 seconds or less, are you able to explain who you are, what you do, and why you're qualified to talk about what we're going to talk about?
Yeah, so my name's Greg Lambrecht. I'm the founder and inventor of Coravin. I'm a serial entrepreneur, now working in wine, but always in medicine. Coravin is a way that allows you to serve any wine you want, in any quantity you want, whenever you want, without having to think about when you're going to serve from that bottle again. It's been an incredible 10 years.
Yeah, well, I was at a trade dinner about 10 years ago, and Daniel Primark brought in like one of the first models and showed everyone. And well, you see a lot of gimmicks in the wine trade, eh? But I think this one was, obviously a little bit different. I'm conscious you've done a few other episodes with people like Tim Atkin recently. I know you sort of talked about your life story. So if people want to listen to that, then go listen to those because they're excellent and, you know, you're beautifully eloquent and it's a really entertaining story. So I'll try not to cover too much of what you've chatted about recently, if that's okay. But are you able to give us a bit of an overview of Coravin as a business? So like, which markets are you in? Where are your biggest markets? How many units have you sold? As many stats and geeky details as you can give us, that'd be great.
Yeah, so we started 10 years ago. We launched Coravin Timeless, which is a needle-based system that puts a needle through the cork to push the wine out of the bottle. That was our first product. We've sold well over 1 million of those. We are in over 60 countries now. We pared back, actually, just recently due to global conflict and war. But we were expanding all the way up until 2021, 22. We're now sort of focusing on our main countries, which are the United States, the first place that we launched, which is our largest market, and then our second largest markets, which are the UK and France. It goes back and forth depending upon currency and whether you're looking at units of dollars or euro or pound, and then Australia and Italy, which are also enthusiastic wine consumers who have picked up Coravin aggressively. We started with the Coravin Timeless needle-based system. During the pandemic, we had our most productive, inventive engineering period because we basically weren't allowed to have anybody in the office except for engineers. So during the pandemic, we launched an upgrade to our Timeless system. We also launched the Pivot system, which pours wine using a stopper. So it'll essentially work with any stopper. It solved our stopper problem. So you could work with Vinolock, you could work with plastic corks, you could work with screw cap or glass, you could start pouring sake and other things with T-tops, like whiskeys and spirits, sherries, old ports. So Pivot launched in 2020, and then Sparkling launched in 2021. So our first opportunity to preserve sparkling wines, which has been a game changer for us. I remember reading a stat that sparkling wine is around 13 to 14% of the overall wine market. And interesting, our sparkling systems are 13% or so of our overall sales. So the sparkling consumer has jumped on it quickly because I think we launched that one in 2022. So it's been an extraordinary rise for sparkling. It's added a new layer to my life because before Coravin Sparkling, I didn't drink any champagne because I couldn't drink it by the glass because I was the Coravin guy and this is how I drank, even at home. And so now I've got this whole world of sparkling wines that are available to me. And the last system that we launched is something called Vinitas. It's the first system that we have that's not specifically, all of Coravin up until now, very intentionally, has been applicable across the entire wine world. So it's used by consumers, it's used by restaurants and wine bars, it's used by wine stores to taste their customers on wine. It's used by wineries and distributors. So it's really across the whole ecosystem. Vinitas is the first thing that we built exclusively for the trade. And it really sort of comes from my CEO, Chris Ladd, and myself believing that wine format is a constraint on its consumption and sale. And that we need to break the connection between the 750 milliliter bottle and the glass of wine the customer wants. Coravin does that at the point of service. We wanted to do it at the point of sale. So Vinitas is a system that is now used to fractionalize bottles by a winery. It's essentially the world's smallest bottling line. It's like the size of a big Nespresso machine, sits on a table and can break down a bottle in a couple of minutes. So it allows customers to have really high quality wine by the glass at the point of purchase. That's our latest system.
Yeah, it was amazing when I saw it. I saw it at Wine Fair. Yeah, it was. It's an extraordinary bit of kit. We're moving to a new office. I recommended we get one because it's just a. It's a great piece.
It's one of the weird side benefits is that you can bring 100 milliliters on a plane. We have a 100 milliliter bottle. It's great.
Oh, nice. And what are you able to tell us what you've got in the pipeline for new inventions? Does it work like that?
We don't yet, but I think we're now at this point where people recognize our goal is to try to expand the ways that wine is enjoyed, served, and sold. And so anything that fits into that category, we will do. I'm a big believer that for wine to grow, you need to break down the price of the glass so you don't have to commit to a full bottle, either at the restaurant or the wine bar or at home. And that the great thing about wine that makes it so unique is its variety, that there's 140,000 different wines bottled every year. And I would love for people to be able to get access to more of them at, more variety at less cost. And so if there's something that we can do to drive that forward, we'll do it. So we'll always do the refinements of our existing systems to make them better, easier, faster, easier, more fun, and independent of closure. But then there's this sort of overarching goal of breaking down the complexity of wine by fractionalizing its consumption. It's a terrible word, fractionalize. I'm still looking for a better one. But to give people access to things that are hard to gain access to when they're sold in a 750 as a price.
So how reliable are each of the systems? Obviously nothing's 100%. The big thing with timeless is user error is a massive factor. Are you able to sort of give us a rough estimate of how reliable they are? I mean, no corks are never reliable. Nothing's totally reliable. But I mean, I've been using mine for years and thoroughly love it. But
It varies across systems. So our overall return rate of Corbin, which is a measure of quality, in other words, do they break? Is under 1%, which for a consumer product is a great thing. I think that comes from both my engineering team and my engineering and manufacturing teams, as well as sort of my background in medicine. I want medical devices to work, right? I can't tolerate failure. And so you build systems that make sure that the systems themselves don't fail, don't break, don't leak, this kind of thing. And I feel like we've done a great job at that. Where we fell down certainly at the beginning was in the instructions for use, because user error, as you were saying. I think when we launched the first Corbin Model 1000, somebody described our instructions for use like hieroglyphics, and it was going to take some PhD and a whole lot of time to figure out what it meant. And what we missed was the opportunity to get the message across that we get now, which is that the use of the timeless system in particular is really important. So I had not realized that people look at Corbin like a corkscrew, and they don't wash their corkscrew. The reality is Corbin is like a wine glass. It touches wine. And so you need to wash it. I was just at our 10-year celebration in London, and there was a famous wine press person who has been using it for 10 years and copped to me that they'd never washed it. And so I'm imagining what's growing out on the inside of their Corbin. And, it's not dangerous, but it's all the things that live in wine, like Brettanomyces, Saccharomyces, Acetobacter, these kind of things. So you have to wash your Corbin. And if you're an owner and user of Corbin and never washed it, please pour cheap vodka down the spout to kill whatever's growing out of the inside. So cleaning was a big thing. So just wash it at the end of the evening, hot water through the spout. Clearing it was another step. So the needle and the valve actually have space in them. And if they sit on your counter and you haven't washed it, there's a little bit of wine that's on the inside of the needle or inside of the valve. And so to clear that before you go to your next bottle, give the trigger a quick press. It sparges the whole system with argon. So you're not injecting that slug of air or wine, oxidized wine, into your next bottle. So clean, clear, and then cellar. People were worried they couldn't store their Corbin wines on their side. It's better for cork if you store them on their side. Keep it cold. Keep it in the dark like you would with normal wine. Corbin doesn't protect wine from all the other things that cause it to go off: heat, light, vibration. So keep it cold. Keep it on side. Those were instructions. Clean, clear, and cellar. I wish I could have dumped out there in the beginning and avoided a lot of a lot of unhappy people with Burgundy that goes off pretty easily if you don't do that. So those are my pieces of advice. Now I'm the evangelist of good Corbin care. With Corbin Sparkling, there is really no maintenance, right? We have a stopper, you rinse it, right? And Pivot's the same thing. So we try in our product evolution to eliminate the issues that we see. And if we can't do it through instructions, we do it through design. But if you use Corbin appropriately, I mean, I'm drinking wines out now. God, I'm getting old. 10, 15 years, quite commonly, post-Corbin. And they're great. Still delicious.
And in terms of cork, so I remember before you said like there's about 6 accesses per cork seems to be kind of the limit. Is there an optimal one? How often does it break corks and damage corks? Is that higher than usual rate of fail for cork closures?
It does not break corks as much as corkscrews do. Corkscrews put a whole lot more force. Our needle's smaller, always Teflon coated. So we don't tend to break corks. The maximum number that I've done is a magnum of Beaucastel 2006 that I was given by Marc Perrin to show at one of his shows in London. And I was pouring it to everybody who came by. So I think I hit 32. Accesses. And I still have that bottle. That was 2013 or 14, so it's 10 years on now. So if the cork quality is good, you can access it as many times as you like. Cork quality comes into play more and more, though, the more times you access it. So really crappy cork, like the Aussies were using back in like the 90s, those don't last. Diam lasts very well. So I've done a lot of testing with DM. They've done a lot of testing with DM. They're harder corks to push the needle through, but they still last. The biggest advice that I give to people is pull the cork for the last glass because people are giving me free gas money by pushing that wine out using Corbin. Feel free to pull the cork. You know, it's one of the side benefits of Corbin is you've always got the right amount left in the bottle for the moment. So if I've got 2 glasses left, my spouse and I want the same thing. I pull the cork and drink it. Saves on gas.
Yeah, we've had it because I do it in my day job of training people. The number of people saying, "Oh, how do you get the last bits out?" Like, well, just take the cork out. Right? And common sense seems to go out the window when they're trying to using a like slightly counterintuitive program. Yeah,
it gives us more gas money, but it makes me feel bad because then people think it doesn't last as long. So I really want to push people toward here are the best ways of using Corbin if you want to save on gas, and pulling the cork is the easiest.
Well, I wanted to ask you a bit about your approach to inventing, which I suppose is quite a broad question. But do you go in with a problem that you want to solve, or do you go in and try and fiddle around with stuff and then see how it applies? And can you take us through your... Do you have like a process or procedure for it, or is it more creative?
I do. I'm very lucky that I was found by my co-founder, Josh Macauer, who's an MD, MBA engineer. He's a walking medical device company. And he hired me into Pfizer with the goal of inventing a process of invention. So he said, look, I don't think that invention is a light bulb going off at random. I think invention can be scheduled. And we're going to break down the components of it. And then we're going to make a schedule around it. And we're going to reliably deliver multiple important inventions in medicine every 3 months. And I just thought the goal was so exciting. And that process is really the process that we developed over the course of 5 or 6 years. He now teaches it at Stanford. I'm involved in teaching it at Harvard in how to invent new medical therapies. And I use the same technique with Corbin. And it does start with the problem. We call them unmet needs. So the unmet need is the core. And you'll see a whole bunch of different products that try to address that unmet need. So even with wine preservation, for example, there's Vacuvan, tries to suck air out. There's spray cans of argon. There's oxygen absorbers. There's Corbin. There's big wall machines. These are all trying to solve the unmet need. And I think the key insight with Corbin is what was specifically that unmet need. And so when I ran into the problem, I believe that the best inventions come from a unique perspective on the unmet need, not on some great new technology. And so my wife was pregnant at the time. She stopped drinking. I had no drinking buddy. I was traveling all the time for medicine. Clearly, I was experiencing a need. I was pulling a cork. It wasn't ready. The wine, we wasted a bottle, or it wasn't what I wanted for dinner, or it wasn't what she wanted. There were all these times when I was running into the frustration that once you open a bottle, it oxidizes over time, and you're committed to that bottle one way or the other. And when it's gone, then you'll open another one, but you're rarely opening two or three at the same time. So I sat down at my table and I started this process of invention that we developed at Pfizer. And I was writing down need statements, a way to better preserve an open bottle of wine. I was like, no, that's not it. I want to be able to taste a wine today, taste it next year, taste it 5 years from now, and watch it evolve. Okay, well, I want a way to teleport wine out of the bottle into my glass without opening it. A way to pour wine from a bottle without opening it. I don't know that that had ever been said before. And if you think about it, separate from the need, it's meaningless. You know, Corbin can come off as a magic trick. I can pour wine from a bottle without opening it. But the real question is why? Why do you want to do that? I wanted to be able to taste three different Chardonnays in an evening. I wanted to be able to taste Riesling from around the world. I wanted to be able to taste a vertical of wine and see how it varied by vineyard and by vintage. I wanted to explore wine in ways that committing to an open bottle did not allow me to do. I wanted to pour one wine for my wife, one wine for myself, one wine for my friend, and have them all three be the perfect wine, whatever they wanted. And that wasn't possible with available technology. So it was, I think what I lucked out on that evening was coming up with the right phrase. And it sounded impossible, pour wine from a bottle without opening it. But then I wrote the next phrase, which was a way to drink any amount of wine from any bottle I want, whenever I want, without having to think when I'm going to drink from it again. That was the real need. And so luckily I'd worked in chemotherapy delivery systems. I was really good at needles and implantable devices that had an access that you could repeatedly strike with a needle underneath the skin. So I had needles that didn't do damage to things. I'm a physicist, so I used to work in plasmas. And I knew about argon plasma, and so I was like, oh, well, argon's an inert gas. And so cobbled together the first prototype of Corvin in my basement. And in the beginning, I thought that unmet need was just mine. But when I started to show it to friends, when they saw how I was drinking differently, how my spouse was drinking differently, how when I had a party, I had 30 bottles on the table and everybody was Corvining whenever they wanted, it changed the way that you interact with wine, and more people started asking me for it. And I knew I'd gotten on to something. So I think if you focus on the unmet need and write it down 5 or 10 different ways when you're running into something, it's not always just the first way you express that need, you know, a better way to preserve an open bottle of wine. I would never have invented Corvin. But I kept working at it to go, what am I really experiencing? Writing is free. And I always say that companies start too quickly. They don't spend the time to think about what is the problem that they're really trying to address? And why is their solution a better reflection of that need than everything else that's already out there? It's a lot of fun. It's my life. It's what I do.
It sounds like time well spent. So, yeah. So in terms of competitors, are there any competitors like or to Corvin? And what do you think of other preservation systems? Because I remember one of them was described to me as the homeopathy of wine preservation, which was one we certainly used to use at work. Yeah, it did absolutely nothing. But what is there out there that you see as a competition?
Well, first, we stand on the shoulders of giants, right? I mean, Vacuvan sold hundreds of millions of devices, sucking air out, and Private Preserve with a spray can of argon does a pretty good job. And it's been around for a long time. Enomatic made it a machine that you could install on a wall and was probably the first to use inert gases to push wine out of a bottle into a glass. So, you know, a lot of respect for them. And Napatech is another competitor in their space, specifically in restaurants and wine bars. And then, you know, there's Corvin. And then I think, you know, my favorite other that I use every once in a while is something called Repor. It's those little packets in beef jerky. This may be an American thing. We order beef jerky and Australians as well. There's this packet in there, and that packet absorbs oxygen. And so it's not silicate, it's something else. And so these guys put it into a stopper and you stick it into a bottle, and it absorbs oxygen from the bottle. My only complaint about them is that they're not recyclable. Which is a bummer. It's one for one. I use them sparingly, but they come in super handy and they work. So Love them. They're great for short-term preservation.
Fair enough. So I wasn't necessarily going to ask you, but in terms of sustainability, do you think that's a consideration that people can do without now?
It is. We think of it in three ways. Number one, let's not produce any non-recyclable stuff as much as we can. So number two, let's make sure our stuff doesn't break so that you have to get a new one. And number three, the largest footprint, carbon footprint in the wine industry is the shipment of glass bottles all over the world. The firing of those glass bottles is a pretty big carbon footprint too, but the shipment is their weight is big. And so the biggest waste is the waste of wine. So here somebody, grew, tended grapes, grew wine the way they wanted to. They produced it the way they wanted to, that they dreamed that they would be able to do. They packaged it in a glass bottle with a closure and a hole. They shipped it from wherever they are to wherever you are. It was stored in cold temperatures, which used electricity. You bring it home, it's not the right wine for the evening, and you dump half of it into a soup or into the drain, right? Or you drink it even though you don't like it. That's probably the biggest waste. And we're trying with everything that we do to prevent that. The secondary piece, our return rate's less than 1%, so we don't break very often. The needles wear out. They're steel, so it should be recyclable. And then the capsule. So the capsule is the biggest part of our recycling. It's metal. It goes into your metal recycling stream. There are different constraints on that metal recycling stream depending upon where you are in the world. But call us. We'll help you find out. In the UK, there's a compressed gas association, which on large scale will pick up lots of capsules. I love the UK for that. In the US, they just go into the metal recycling stream, which is great. We've looked at making reusable capsules. The problem is the complexity of the carbon footprint. Shipping metal capsules to central locations actually is worse. So recycling locally is better. I would love to figure out a way to make the Coravin system itself fully recyclable. It's hard because of cost constraints. And we work with a high pressure gas, right? We're working with 2,800 pounds per square inch. And so you need the materials that can tolerate that kind of load. And unfortunately, they're plastic. They're recyclable as much as plastic is recyclable. But if there's one thing I could do to help us, it would be that. It would be to try to make that either use less of it or make it fully recyclable. We think about it a lot.
Nice. I suppose that ties in quite nicely to the exam question you're going to ask. But what do you think is the future of traditional wine packaging? Cans have got their day, but obviously, if everything was cans, you'd have to rethink your business model pretty quickly. Right? And they've got their problems. What do you see as being, from a physicist, from an inventor, from a wine lover? What do you see the future
being? I think the glass bottle's going to stay. I think that you're going to see half bottle, Magnum, and bigger, because it's such a traditional, it's a great storage container, right? Hundreds of years. And it's an incredible thing. What a great invention, cork and glass. That was just brilliant. That was a good one. But it is too expensive on a single serve level. So the expansion of wine packaging is going to move into single serve. We see it with cans. Cans are limited in a bunch of ways. Their shelf life is short because of the way they're made and the way that they're accessed. The liners on the inside of the aluminum can can't tolerate certain wines. So some wines are okay, some wines are not okay. Glass is universal, works with everything. So we need to find a lightweight, fully recyclable, single serve container for wine. We haven't found it yet. We are going to find it because the customer need is too strong. People want to be able to go into a store, grab a can of wine, and drink it that night. Or grab three or six different cans of wine and drink that over the course of a week and explore wine in a more approachable volume, just like you buy beer. So I think it is going to be lightweight. I'm going to put my money on aluminum can, or a variant thereof. Currently Coravin's, Vinitas is soda lime glass and a screw cap. And that's better, right? Cause we can pour you a glass of wine that we can ship. It's lighter than a full bottle, and you can, for the weight of a full bottle, have seven different wines. So I think that's better. Glass is going to reach a limit of durability and weight. So, and aluminum is wonderful. And all the amazing amount of energy being poured into that packaging, it's made it the lightest container ever developed by human beings. The Coke can. It's the modern Coke can is the lightest liquid container ever developed by human beings. So, you know, I'm a big fan. I was in Iceland recently. And, you know, the biggest carbon footprint, I'm going to get nerdy for a second. The biggest carbon footprint of aluminum is the smelting of the bauxite ore. It takes an enormous amount of energy. Well, Iceland has geothermal energy aplenty. And so the energy is essentially spilling out of the ground. And so they put a bauxite smelting facility on their southern shore. And so people can move their ore into Iceland and get aluminum carbon neutral. It's amazing. Right? So I'm psyched by aluminum. I think it's going to solve the problem. We've experimented with it for our Vinitas. The liner and variability to wine issue is a big one. So whoever's going to solve that problem, if it's not us, the goal is to find the edge cases that are meaningful and find what works. Please.
All right, cool. Well, let's talk a little bit sort of geekily about the brand, I suppose, itself. What measures or metrics do you use to determine the strength of any of the brands that you work on? I mean, I suppose it'd be comparable to look at it. Do you look at Coravan in the same way you look at your medical company, or is it more of a labor love? How do you measure it?
It's different from medical companies in a way. The business model of Coravan is what's called a durable and a captured consumable. So we have a reusable system and we have a captured consumable, and those exist in the medical world as well. Electrosurgical tools are a great example. And so I like that business model if we can, because it's a way of measuring use. If you sell one and you're done, you know, like Instapot, ultimately you run out of people to sell it to. And then your game is over. So we measure not only the sale of systems, so a Coravan Timeless, like a Model 3 or a Model 6 or a Pivot or a Sparkling, but also the use of the gas capsules that go along. Because that means that so my goal as an inventor is to positively influence as many people as I can before I die. And so with medicine, it's very easy. If it's an implant, I count the implants, right? How many implants are we doing? We know it helps in this situation. So we're making people's lives better. With Coravan, it's every glass of wine that's served. Every glass of wine is in one way touching that person and giving them an opportunity to have a moment that they tailor to themselves and make it the best, hopefully the best moment possible with the materials that they've got, with the wine that they have. That's my goal. And so, you know, the aggregate, the big number, which is really kind of shocking, is that we've served more than 250 million glasses of wine. And that's 250 million moments we've touched somebody's life with our products. But when you look at it on an annual basis, you're really looking for utilization. So how many times does a customer buy and then come back and buy more capsules? Or do they buy the system, they're frustrated with it, they don't like it, they don't use it, and it sits in the drawer. I want to prevent the latter. I want them to have a great experience out of the box, have it change their lives, have them experience what it's done for me at home. I buy all my capsules, even though I know a guy, but I buy all my capsules. Right? I buy all my capsules to experience what it's like. Is this worth it to me? To buy these capsules, to use the system, to change the way I drink wine. It absolutely is. So how do we communicate that to a customer to encourage them to use the system in the way that adds the greatest joy to their lives? And so for me, the metric is how many of our customers come back within the first 3 or 6 months to buy more capsules? It's a tricky metric because we sell in so many places. We sell on Amazon. We sell on Coravan's websites around the world. We sell in retail stores. We sell through distributors. It's also complicated by the breadth of customer type we have. Wineries use a different number of capsules than restaurants and wine bars, which use the most. And then the consumer. And then we've got also people who buy a Coravan for a friend. So it's a gift. The holiday seasons, a lot of Coravans are sold. So how do you communicate with somebody who's one step removed to explain to them what Corbin is and what it does. Because it's, you know, the unmet need that we talked about, any wine, any amount, whenever I want, without having to think about it, is a new concept, especially in the home. And so how do you communicate that in still imagery and text? How do you communicate that with video online? And I always say to my team, please don't ever put a video online that shows only one bottle of wine. Because the value of Corbin is the ability to drink 2-3 different wines in an evening, or serve one to a friend and one to yourself, right? How do we get that message across to give people a window on that possible future that they have with wine? That's my challenge. I want to see the highest possible repeat sales in 3 to 6 months. That's my big metric.
Does that differ by country? I mean, I presume they have different drinking there's different drinking amounts, of different drinking styles. Like, are there any noticeable, like, case studies, I suppose?
Absolutely. The UK and Australia use a lot of capsules. Okay. And so the reason that is because of trade penetration, restaurants and wine bars. It's difficult for us to break out restaurants and wine bars in our data, so it gets a little cloudy. But the capsules per device sold in the UK and Australia are very, very high. And it's because the majority of use still is in the trade. I think we're 50-50, 50% trade, 50% consumer. Whereas in the United States, we're 90% consumer and 10% trade. And so you'll see a shift in the capsule consumption, because consumers just don't use, very few consumers use as many as a restaurant or wine bar. Those are the big differences. France and the United States are surprisingly similar in their behavior. A lot of home use, harder to use it in the restaurant, with notable exceptions. France also uses a lot of Corbin in the winery, as does the United States in Napa, Oregon, Washington, and across the U.S. So there's some regional variation, but I think it's by customer type rather than habit.
So what's the, why, is there a reason for that France and the US don't use it much in the trade? Because it's a sommelier's dream, right? So you'd think.
Yeah. But. Germany's the greatest example. I went to Germany to show Corbin to restaurants and wine bars. Our sales in Germany were dismal, right? We were just not breaking through. And I had a German sommelier say, you know, wine is served like this. It's inside this box. Wine is served like this inside this box. You are outside of the box. We don't go outside of the box. We serve wine inside the box. And that has changed dramatically recently, but it just took years to express the fear of changing tradition, especially in a well-respected restaurant. You feel like you've got something you don't want to screw up, and they protect that tradition. And Corbin is new. How is their customer going to respond? How is Guy de Michelin going to respond? How's my owner going to respond? That's a different thing. Whereas in the UK and in Australia, they're like, well, it's Tool. I can serve whatever I want. This is great. And it just flipped overnight. I think there is definitely a window into a culture that comes from Corbin. And if they're very aggressive at protecting tradition, they are more resistant to Corbin because it's a change, even if it makes them more money and makes their guests happier. Biggest dichotomy was Bordeaux and Burgundy. Bordeaux, I got walked out of two Bordeaux producers when I showed them Corbin before we launched. So it was my tradition to go to the wineries and say, we're using our product on yours. Here's Corbin. Let me show you how it works. Here's a Corbin. Please use it and test it and determine whether or not you like it or don't before we launch. And in Bordeaux, I was walked out of two Bordeaux producers. One of the producers said they were going to put a metal disc underneath the foil to break the needle. They were really hostile, except for a couple of rare examples or exceptions. Aubailly being a big one, Lynchbage being another big one, Aubryon, surprisingly. But there were the majority of people walked me out, or didn't like it. Then I went to Burgundy, and they accepted it immediately. So I think even between wine regions, you can find different personalities inside of the same country. Burgundy, they're farmers. This is a tool. They don't have much wine. Right? They don't even have much for themselves. Right? They use it at home. Right? So it's just a different culture driven by different needs.
Well, this does actually lead quite nicely onto another exam question. You're probably going to say yes to this. I'm going to get, does the wine trade lack innovation? So, does it in general?
I think like any industry, it needs to be done the right way. There's two, it was Will.i.am, the singer entrepreneur. Will.i.am said something great. He's like, I think of disruptive innovation as something that comes into an existing field, works with that field, and makes it better. He's like, there's another form of disruptive innovation that doesn't care about the existing field, comes in and bashes it over the head with whatever it's got, and is going to force them out of the way to make itself more important, whether or not it's profitable. And he said, I like the former. I agree with you. I like the former. So when we, without the appropriate launch plan, you will fail in the wine industry because it is conservative. So it's extremely important to recognize sort of the hierarchy of control in the wine industry, which I spent a lot of time on before we launched because I was new to it, right? I'm coming from medicine. And in medicine, there are a couple of key physicians who make a big impact on people. And so the corollary in wine is the winery. If wineries hate you, you're toast. Because they speak to restaurants and wine bars. They speak to wine stores. They speak to distributors. If they saw Coramin being used on their product and they didn't understand what it was, and the first time they see it is out in a restaurant, they're like, what the heck is that? And what's it doing to my wine? We would have failed. So we called it the kiss the ring strategy, right? So we went to the top winery. Yes. All right. I'm a lapsed Catholic. So the top of the pyramid is the winery, but beneath them is the restaurant and wine bar. Beneath them is the consumer, and the trade is somewhere swarming around. And so we went to the wineries, we went to the top restaurants and wine bars, gave them systems to use to get their feedback before we launched, and then launched once we had sort of a quorum of people that were excited. And that worked. On the other hand, if you don't do that, I mean, Screwcap is a great example, right? It was invented by the French in the 1950s to preserve, or 40s, to preserve spirits. And still isn't on much French wine, right? It's a great closure. You don't need a tool, right, to open it. You just crack it open. It is a great tool, and it took the Australians to wholesale switch over on Riesling 1 year to push it into the market finally. It's a great closure. I hope we see more of it. But they launched wrong.
Is there anything with your launch you would have done differently? I know you had mentioned the instructions bit that you would have done would have been different. In terms of actual coming to market, is there anything looking back that you wish you'd done differently or could have done better?
You know, I would love to have. So what Nespresso did when they launched their machine was they sold their machine through anybody, but they sold their capsules only through themselves. And that way they always maintain a relationship with a customer. I think it's good for Nespresso. I don't think it's good for their customer. Sometimes I think about it. I wish I had done that. I wish we had launched the system through everybody and the capsule resales were only through us, because that would have allowed me to communicate with the customer more consistently over the first 3 months to explain to them, you know, better than potentially retail where they just pick up a box or they receive it as a gift. But I don't know if that would have been better for my customer. It would have been better for me, but I don't know if it would have been better for the customer. So, and that cat's out of the bag. I think that, you know, the big challenge in the wine industry is how broad it is. So in spine surgery, where I work now, there's 5,000 surgeons in the United States who do my procedure. If I worked really hard, I could see them all in 2 years to explain to them what Varicade does, my spinal implant. There are 36 million Americans who drink all the wine. How do you get to 36 million Americans? I think we did a good job. I think we were enamored with the magic trick that Corbin was without, interestingly, incorporating into our communications the unmet need we were addressing. So, hey, you want to see a way I can pour wine from a bottle without opening it? Isn't that cool? Yeah, but why would I want to pay money for that? Hey, do you want a way that you can drink any wine from any bottle or serve any wine from any bottle whenever you want without having to think about when you're going to drink from it again? Totally different sales pitch. We started with the first one. Now all we're doing is the second one. And so we've had to sort of catch up. I wish we could have started with the, I don't know why I let that slip, but we didn't start with the need. We started with the tech. And always start with your need. Always, if you're pitching a new technology or a new idea, always start with the need you're solving, because that is what connects with people.
It's bonkers to think that 90% of Americans don't drink wine. I can't get my head around it.
Yeah. It is. We are weird. I mean, that's another one. Portugal, right? Everybody drinks wine. It's like 80%. Australia, there's 27 million people, and I think they start at three, right? 3 years old, taste wine. I mean, they're great. Swiss, right? You see that difference, right, across countries. Yeah, in the U.S., it's 10% of the people drink 90% of the wine. It's a problem for the wine industry, a real problem. And I think it comes from packaging. I think it comes from the fact that you've got to buy a full six pack of beer is the equivalent at a pretty high price in order to drink one beer, whether or not you like that beer. So you got to buy six to find out whether or not you like it. Right? That's the wine world. How do we fix that? How do we make it easier, more approachable? Celebrity is helping, but format's going to make a difference.
So I wanted to ask a little bit about your capsules, because I had seen videos of people trying to bootleg and put in like CO2 ones into a Coravan, which seems like a daft idea because it's just going to make your wine a bit weird.
But don't do that. Right.
Well, obviously you say don't. Has anyone tried bootlegging the capsules yet? I presume it's under patent, but I mean,
We do. The thing that I've seen the most, and it's not everywhere, is there are restaurants who've taken a big tank of argon, a hose, and they've modified one of our capsules and their device by some drilling and some welding to make a big tank accessible argon for Corbin. We didn't do that at the beginning. We thought about it as a trade. The reason we didn't do it is the only thing that's dangerous about argon is argon in large quantity. You can't tell it's there because it has no smell and no taste, and you suffocate. And so we did not want, there's use of argon in industrial situations. You have to have floor level suction and venting to prevent people from asphyxiating. And so I warn every restaurant that I see doing that. I'm like, hey, if you're going to do that, it's not even safe with nitrogen in really big tanks, but it's safer. You might want to use nitrogen. So CO2 is bad. It not only freezes our valve, which breaks it. So don't use CO2. But it also bubbles the wine. We are beginning to see some counterfeits out of China. This reminds me of a great story. I got kicked out of Bordeaux in part because I thought Corbin was going to be used for counterfeiting, which it hasn't been. And I went to Germany. I was visiting Robert Weil right afterwards. And I said, are you worried about counterfeiting? And he looked at me and he goes, I should be so famous. I thought that was so cool. One of my engineers walked up to me when we found these Chinese counterfeit capsules. He goes, Craig, you've finally been so famous. You're getting knocked off by China. Unfortunately, they don't work. They look just like ours. They don't have a laser printed expiration date on them yet. That's the way you can tell that they're fake. But they leak, and we have no idea. We're testing the gas now. It smells like a chemical factory. So I would not. We're trying to figure out how to, we're shutting it down on Amazon. They're only in the US. So counterfeiting is something I'm a little worried about because we, Argonne touches wine. We do a lot of work with our partners who make gas for us in Austria and Hungary to make sure that the capsules are clean, the gas is pure. And that's not what we're seeing coming out of the counterfeits. So I don't know. That's my big fear. I'm less worried about the loss of revenue. I just want to make sure that everybody's safe in using these capsules. So you can tell they're also fake. Just grab the top, that plastic bit on the top, spin it. It'll spin right off.
Well, there's an exam question which it was one of these sort of paper five ones, but it's has science taken the romance out of wine? I'm guessing you'll probably say no, but and I probably my favorite bit of it is the really geeky science side of things. I bore the tits off people on a regular basis talking about it, but do you think science has or could take the romance out of wine as a subject?
Yeah, absolutely. Science for science's sake, right? Has always been bad. You've got to address an unmet need that's meaningful and then introduce it in a way that doesn't clash with the culture that's there, that integrates with it. But, you know, I'm trying to think of an example of science for science sake. But I saw this wild thing to serve a wine by the glass cold, no matter what the temperature was. And it had like salt liquids in a bag gel thing that was in your freezer, and you poured the wine through the spout and it went spiraling down through something and then poured it in your glass. I was like, wow, right? That it's not that hard to get wine at the right temperature, right? So that unmet need is not solved by this solution. Wine is an elegant thing. So, you know, there's a ceremony involved with it. And so, you know, if you can make sure that there's a ceremony involved in the technology that you have, and if you can make an elegance out of the technology that you deliver or the science that you deliver, then I don't think it has to take the romance out of wine. But then, you see optical scanning grape sorting machines, which are, from a technology standpoint, from my perspective, beautiful. But boy, are they technology, right? Little jets of air firing bad grapes out as they're flying over a line. The customer doesn't interact with it. And so there's a lot of technology in wine that does not affect, the customer doesn't see. And it doesn't impact the romance. So either make it transparent or integrate with the culture and you should be okay.
Nice. It's good to see you still got the romance in there. I like that.
Oh, I love wine. I don't know if I've got that. Yeah. Like, it is, it's the first medicine, right? It is what a spectacular beverage this thing is. 8,000 years old, you know, only beers older, as far as we can tell. And I they're going to find something, I'm sure, that's, you know, even older than 8,000 and 10,000 years for beer and wine. Those two, mild alcohol, non-distilled, you can drink it every day. You know, you don't have to get drunk to drink it when you're drinking it. It doesn't burn. It's delicious, pairs with food. I mean, and you relax. Like, I don't know that there's a more fun part of my day than coming home with my spouse and she has a glass of sparkling, Pitch for Corbin sparkling, and I have a glass of still, and we're talking to each other, right? It's a beautiful thing. I love wine. I will never damage wine with science. So it's not my goal.
Is there any science that could actively damage it? So like the way that people say that AI could damage conversations with people, is there anything that you think could be actively damaging to it? Like something that maybe like could create wine from a chemical composition rather than from fermentation or something? Like, I mean, is there anything that you think, is that technology available?
It is happening. I'm not a fan of it. I don't understand why you would do it. I don't, you know, why not grow? The great thing about wine is where it came from, right? It's terroir. I love that. And one of the second best thing to wine is wine tourism and going around and seeing these places where it's made and meeting the people that make it. So I think that there is damaging technology, constructing wine in a lab. But then there's the corollary of that. There's a company that showed me some technology that was really interesting. I didn't know what it was going to do, but they could on the fly reduce the alcohol level in a controllable way to whatever you want. So you can take a bottle of wine that's at 15%, make it 12, or make it 8, or make it 6, or make it 9, through a very rapid filtration process. And I look at that and I think, you know, I would never have thought to do that. But if I was sitting in a restaurant and somebody offered me the same wine at 3 different alcohol levels, certainly the first time I would order it. I would just be interested in tasting it. And, you know, but you think about the winemaker, right? The winemaker's going to go, hey, what the hell are you doing to my wine? So, yeah, I never say never right at the start. If they're addressing a need, even if it's one that I didn't see before they showed it to me, it still has value. I don't think there's too much. I mean, we saw the use of pesticides, right? And Federico Ceretto of Ceretto Wines in Barolo was standing on top of the hill of Canubi, and they've gone functionally biodynamic, but they're certainly organic. And standing up on top of this hill, and he said to me, you know, do you know what plant has been here for over 2,000 years? It's the grapevine. Like, you know, we live in an ecosystem where we've got this one monocrop. And if we fight, like we have been for the last 50 years, against the things that naturally feed, what we call pests, in some new way, they will win. And we will lose. And so he said, you know, by pulling back, I think for them, it was in 2009, and switching and letting more trees grow in, tearing up some lines, letting more trees grow and let more of the natural biosphere restore, their wines, I've tasted on either side, their wines have gotten better. And they don't have a whole lot of loss. So I think sometimes there is technology for technology's sake. Roundup is dangerous in my mind, right? And antibiotics, same example, overuse of antibiotics in food and people results in evolving bacteria that will kill you. So, you know, don't cause them to evolve. Don't push in the wrong direction with your technology. Looks good up front, but for the rare exception.
Fair enough. Well, listen, I'm conscious we're coming to our time. There's one final question I always like to ask people. What are the major causes of optimism in the wine world today?
Major causes of optimism, more better wines being made now in more places than anywhere else, than ever in history. There are more better, different wines. We understand how to make wine. We can make it in the mountains of Chile, in the mountains of Shangri-La. We can make it, you know, in deserts. We can make it anywhere. And so the English sparkling, for example, that's another. I just had some amazing English sparkling. Had a wine out of Norway, had it out of the Netherlands. So, you know, this is the only upside of global warming, I guess, is that new places are growing it. So I'm excited by the continued passion and evolution of the wine producing world, as it broadens out into new areas, it's forced to do so. And so I think that's one. Two, cans, they are there. You know, Corbin doesn't work with them, but they're a great idea. So the more we can get wine to work with can to work with wine, the better. Single serve is coming, and that'll be great. So I think that's optimism. And then you still have the creativity, I call them, it's like painters with paint, the sommelier at restaurants. There's still a deep passion of sommelier to excite people about this beverage that they love. And that, as long as that passion is there to introduce people to wine in wine stores, wine retail, I do hope wine retail survives. Online is great, but and I order all my wine online, but I do walk into those stores every once in a while and buy a bottle because I love talking to those people and learning what they love. So I think wine retail has gotten more efficient and better. I think cans are coming, and I think that we can make great wine all over the world, and there's passion to do so. So there's optimism. We've got to figure it out, though, because the world is always changing.
Well, you seem like an optimistic guy, but yeah, you're definitely doing a lot of good, I think. Well, listen, yeah, we're coming up to our time now. So, thank you so much for that, Greg. That was fantastic.
Thank you, Ron. I really appreciate the time and the very creative questions, the ones I haven't asked.